Hello again. This is John Ziegel, and it's the spring of 1987, and this is the long-awaited tape 4. It's been nearly 3 years since I think this will be my best tape. Well, it needs to be. What you are going to hear will no doubt raise a few eyebrows and perhaps shock a few people. It's a story that's been known to only a few. We're going to talk about meetings that you were never invited to, strategies that never appeared in the AAC Journal or were never spoken of at David's lectures. These are the things I want to put into perspective for you. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself. Needless to say, we have all been through an ordeal together leaving the church. The quote, heyday, unquote, of the field, and then the reality of what we actually ended up with in the field. And that's not much to speak of. A heap of ashes might be an apt description. I don't think this fact comes to you as any great surprise. All you have to do is look around, and you can see for yourself that this is true. But the purpose of this tape is not to tell you what you already know. In the next hour, we're going to look hard at what happened, what really happened, behind the scenes in the field, and I think it might answer some questions for you. As you know, I've been in and out of the thick of this for some time. Being on the inside, I knew quite a bit that was going on in the field that you were not privy to. But even with all the first-hand data that I had, I was puzzled over why we were having so much trouble with the lawsuit that the church filed against myself, the AAC, and a few others in the field. This was the suit that dealt with the stolen Knott's materials. By the way, many blamed this lawsuit as the reason why the AAC had to close down. But I knew better, for I saw the field deteriorating long before the suit was ever filed. But again, I'm ahead of myself. As to why I began this quest, I didn't understand why we were losing in the courtroom, particularly a case in which I thought we were innocent. Nothing added up anymore. The field had virtually disappeared. So I started asking some questions, some very hard questions, and I found some answers. To be honest, I really didn't know who to trust at this point. So while doing this, I separated myself out from just about everybody. My search took me back and forth on the time track and through a pile of paper that would overwhelm any attorney. What I found was shocking, so shocking, in fact, that at several points in time, I decided that I simply didn't want to look anymore. I didn't like what I was finding, and I didn't like confronting the fact that a few people I had really trusted had let me down. As for this tape, it is largely a document-based tape. I must have read a stack of documents 6 feet or about 2 meters high. Mostly court records and depositions available to anyone. From this, a time track grew, which I added to my own eyewitness knowledge of what had happened in the field. It was not an easy job. There were many disheartening, disappointing, and angering moments while I was putting that time track together. It may be that the truth will set you free, but nobody said that gathering it wasn't painful, and at times even embarrassing. If you hear me turning pages while this tape is going on, it's because, frankly, I've written out a lot of the material in advance. Because so much of this has come from research and putting together timelines and so forth, I felt it was necessary to have accurate notes before I began. And while I'm at it, I also invite you to do your own search to verify what I'm about to tell you. As a matter of fact, I implore you to examine this for yourself and base your conclusions on first-hand data instead of taking someone else's word for it. Probably the best way to start is with some current facts, and then we can work from there. It is a fact that the AAC is gone. Stockton is gone. Candacraig is gone. The Clear Center is perhaps 10% of its former self. Many others are also gone. As to those who remain, good old Standard Tech is just a distant memory. You've probably seen some of the garbage passed off as tech. This is it, the thing to crack your case, a Ouija board. Give me a break. And a far cry from what we were talking about back in 1983, I might add. And if Standard Tech is what you are looking for, there is no place in the field to find it. That, too, is an indisputable fact. And another fact that cannot be ignored is that the U.S. federal courts have not been kind in their treatment of the AAC and some other field centers. All PR aside, I worked on the AAC legal case and am also familiar with other cases with other centers, so I know how things are really going, and overall they are not going well. That brings us to where I started my investigation. You see, the church's lawsuit, reduced to its simplest language, claimed that the Knott's material that was stolen in Denmark was transferred to David Mayo and the AAC in violation of several statutes. This, of course, is an oversimplification of the suit, but it will suffice for our purposes. When the church first filed its lawsuit over the theft of the Knott's material, I distinctly remember getting together with David Mayo and a few other associates up at the AAC, and we discussed the case at length. We talked and talked, and the more we talked, the more sure I became that we had a strong defense to this case. I was assured by David that he had nothing to do with the theft of the upper-level materials in Denmark, and that these materials had not been sent to his center, and I believed him. But loss after loss in front of Judge Feltzer, the judge in this case, made me quite confused. I kept asking myself, why were we losing? What had we done to pull this in? I couldn't quite get my finger on it. I remember several times questioning David on this point, asking him at some length if he had anything to do with this theft or the receipt of the stolen materials. I didn't want to waste my time defending the suit if he had actually been guilty of this, and I was not about to waste my time raising money to pay for a defense if, in fact, the AAC was guilty of a crime. Assured repeatedly that David was innocent, we used this legal case to rally the field to raise funds for our legal defense. The battle cry became, "You could be next." To be honest, we didn't know whether the "you could be next" line was necessarily true or not, but it was an acceptable line since we really needed money and David Mayo was innocent, right? Well, we'll see. But my objective was to question everything either side said. I didn't know who to trust or believe. Now, nearly 2 years later, I have a very disturbing tale to tell you. What I'm about to tell you is all contained in the public records that you can find just as I did. It's all there, and I am bitter and angry with what I have found. I'm bitter because I was lied to, and I used my comm lines and skills to pass that lie along. That lie was used to raise money. It was used to keep another lie alive, and that really frosts me. Let's review this whole scene, and I'll show you how I came to conclude that David did indeed come into possession of the stolen Knott's pack. I came to this conclusion from publicly available evidence, including many documents from the files of the AAC and the files of David Mayo himself. Some of the details you may know about, some I am sure you do not. Basically what happened is this. On December the 9th, 1983, Robin Scott, along with two accomplices, stole three Knott's packs and a Class 8 pack from the AO in Denmark. This is now a well-known fact and is not disputed by anyone. We, in the field, actually regarded this as good news. We all hoped we would be able to get the real Knott's data, and of course, within days of the theft, we knew who had stolen the materials. Prior to and during this time, David insisted that these materials were unnecessary, as he could reconstruct the Knott's pack from memory. But it's interesting to note that he never released anything until after the theft. The AA5 pack simply did not exist before the theft, even though David often talked about how much he wished he had a pack finished. Then, all of a sudden, in January 1984, not long after the theft, the pack comes out. Advance payments were coming into the AAC, and by February 1984, AA5, or Knott's, was finally being delivered. This was broadly promoted. David had finished the pack, his reconstruction. Time for celebration. The RTC, however, saw it differently, and in January of 1985, they filed a suit against Robin Scott and his accomplices, Ron Lawley, Mareg Belmain, and Steve Bisbee, and against the AAC, David Mayo, John Nelson, Harvey Haber, myself, my then-wife Vivian, concerning the theft and possession of these Knott's materials. Now we're going to take a look at what I call the Knott's connection, because this is where the story gets a little bit more interesting. To begin, let me give you some history and some idea of who the players were at the start of this game. David Mayo, John Nelson, Harvey Haber, and Dee Dee Riesdorf were all ex-CFS management people who formed the AAC in Santa Barbara. Lawley, Bisbee, Belmain, themselves also ex-CORG, formed the nucleus of a group they hoped would one day be a fully-fledged AAC in East Grinstead. Robin and Adrian Scott, who had resigned from the church in the fall of 1983, were also former Sea Org members who worked for the Folo UK, and at one point Robin had even been deputy commanding officer there. Adrian, who was also in Folo UK, I believe was the HAS. They would later form the AAC Kenda Craig. But the real story begins months earlier. You know the old Dianetic command, is there an earlier beginning? Yes, there is an earlier beginning. Ron Lawley and Steve Bisbee, as early as May or perhaps June 1983, had stolen Solo through OT3 from AOSHUK, using an inside accomplice. This is a matter of court record. Then in July of 1983, Jeannie Hansen, a close friend of Lawley and Bisbee, made a trip to see David Mayo. I have no evidence that the stolen Solo through OT3 materials were given to David, but it does explain a strange conversation that I had with him. I offered him the similar materials from the Clear Center. Thanks, he said, but we have all we need. That was curious to me, because our very first conversations, and from then on many conversations, centered around the unavailability and scarcity of materials, and that was a constant problem. Now, all of a sudden, he seemed to have all the materials he needed. That seemed illogical to me, but I accepted it at face value. And I didn't know about the Lawley Bisbee June theft at that time. But we still did not have the Knots Pack. During the fall of 1983, both Ron Lawley and Robin Scott begin a series of letters with David Mayo. Both indicate they want to affiliate with the AAC in Santa Barbara and deliver services up through Solo Knots. Scott indicated that he wanted to send a staff member to Santa Barbara for training. On October the 1st, 1983, Robin Scott attempts a theft. He approaches an AOUK staff member, asks him to steal Knots and other confidential materials, and in exchange he would receive a £20,000 per year job. The staff member tells Robin to shove off and writes up the attempt. On October the 6th, 1983, Bob Ainsworth of Robin Scott's group in Kendacraig writes to David Mayo and says he would like to deliver Knots. And he was, quote, figuring out how to get the materials, unquote. Make a note of that. Later that fall, Harvey Haber from the AAC in Santa Barbara traveled to Spain for a convention of independence and then went on to East Grinstead. During his stay there, Harvey had meetings with Ron Lawley, Steve Bisbee, and Morag Belmain, among others. The seeds of the AAC East Grinstead are sown. I can't imagine that they didn't discuss the earlier theft, and perhaps the one to come. As late as November the 17th, AAC regs are still replying to requests for Knots or AA5 training by saying the AAC does not currently deliver that training and they cannot give a date certain when it will be available. Soon was all that was said. Then the second theft. On December the 9th, 1983, Scott, Lawley, and Belmain travel to Copenhagen. They enter the AO in Denmark and take three Knots packs and one Class 8 course pack, as we said before. Scott takes one pack and goes back to Scotland. Lawley and Belmain take others and return to East Grinstead. Immediately on their return to East Grinstead, Lawley and Belmain join up with Steve Bisbee, and they go directly to Martin Rustin's office to Xerox copies of the stolen materials. But here is the clincher. This is clincher number one, and one part of the story you were never told. The same day of the theft, the very day that the stolen Knots materials were being Xeroxed, the AAC made two phone calls to Martin Rustin's office. They were right in the phone records. I didn't even know about those phone calls when I was working on the legal case. And now clincher number two. On December the 20th, Harvey Haber from the AAC in Santa Barbara picks up the phone and calls Ron Lawley in East Grinstead, and they talk for over half an hour, overseas. This is no ordinary phone call, and Harvey takes notes on their conversation. Those notes have been introduced into the court. In those notes, he states that the AAC would get, quote, the materials. Lawley, Bisbee, and Belmain would not give copies of the materials to anyone other than David Mayo and the AAC. In exchange, they would get AAC affiliation. Just as a parenthetical remark, do you see the ramifications of that? They also got 2-for-1 price or 50% discount to train their staff at the AAC in Santa Barbara. Talk about a smoking gun. Why Harvey wrote all this down, I'll never know, but he did, and a copy of it is in the court files for you to see for yourself. Affiliation with known thieves. This same note also mentions that John Nelson is planning a trip to East Grinstead in early January of 1984, and he will work out the fine points at that time. David Mayo apparently was told of this deal soon after the telephone call. Now, you must remember that as of January 1, 1984, there was still no AA5 pack at the AAC, only the lectures given by David to a select few. In January, Nelson took off to East Grinstead and met with Lawley and Bisbee, who had the stolen Knott's pack. At that time, the affiliation was made official, with Lawley, Bisbee, and Belmain as the board of directors of the AAC East Grinstead. Nelson also made a quick trip to Candacraig to talk with Robin Scott. The deals were closed just as Harvey had laid them out back on December the 20th. In addition, Candacraig agreed to pay over 5% of its gross income to the AAC in Santa Barbara. I might add at this point that it was certainly ethically questionable to be in communication with these people. To affiliate with these people as AACs, as it is a matter of court record that these people were criminals, is ludicrous. We're talking about simple outright theft now. Regardless of the arguments, religious or philosophical, used to justify it, it was purely a criminal act, like somebody entering your home and stealing something from you. But what about David Mayo getting the Knott's pack? David and I had talked a few times about the chances of getting one, but he kept saying to me that he wouldn't want to get involved with anything illegal, so no, he didn't want a hot Knott's pack. I believed him. Clincher number three. All of a sudden, as if dropped from heaven, the AA5 bulletins start coming out, bang, 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 one after the other. In my deposition in this case, they had me go through the complete AA5 pack and read the date on each issue. Issue number 1, January 1984. Issue number 2, January 1984. Issue number 3, January 1984. I don't think I need to continue with this, do I? All of the bulletins of the AA5 pack all came out in 1 month, and all of them came out in January 1984. I didn't catch it, even as it stared me in the face. There I sat in the room with the attorneys and the papers and everything. It just never occurred to me at the time that David had written the entire AA5 pack in 1 month or less, the whole deal. That must have been some month. One then must ask this burning question. If David Mayo could reconstruct Knott's from memory into AA5 in only a month, why hadn't he done it in the month of August 1983? Or how about the months of September or October or November or December? People were clamoring for the services. Why wait? We considered that there was big money to be made in delivering those services. And besides, memory fails with time. On March the 13th, 1984, Robin Scott was arrested in Copenhagen. On March the 14th, by the time the news had reached the AAC, calls were made from the AAC to Ron Lawley, Steve Bisbee, and Morag Belmain. Nearly 45 minutes altogether in overseas phone calls, all on that day. Did you know that the AAC Journal for that period originally featured a page on the new AAC Candacraig? No, you don't, because these, in fact, were never mailed. Instead, they were destroyed, and a new issue, deleting all references to Robin Scott and the AAC Candacraig, was produced and distributed. Now that the arrest had occurred, David needed to distance himself from Scott. Court records show that all the terms of the agreement negotiated by Nelson and Haber were carried out. It would then be illogical to assume that the final and most important term of the agreement had also not been carried out, and that was the transfer of the stolen Knott's back to the AAC. It would be illogical for this not to have occurred. The evidence strongly suggests that David did possess a copy of the stolen Knott's pack. It was really quite tricky to piece all this together, but all I did was read and take careful notes on the trial documents, the testimony in court, the depositions, and the documents used as evidence, and so on. And it's all right there for anyone to see. Now, you have to realize that I did not know all this when I was doing my tapes and working on raising money for the legal defense of the lawsuit. While some might not care that the materials were stolen from the church, it bothers me. I feel betrayed when I look at how much money was spent defending a lawsuit in which we were apparently guilty. When I take a look at how much time was spent helping David, who I feel was not open and honest with me about the facts of the case, I feel very angry. My life and future was on the line. Apparently, he just didn't care. I find it upsetting to realize that I was taken in by all of this. and the PR line that I helped forward, given to me by David Mayo, in the end turned out to be the lie. After the suit was filed, I launched into the legal arena. From June 85 through August 85, I worked full-time. I attended all depositions, hearings, read all the motions and other legal papers. It was an amazing stack of paperwork. David and I had hours of discussions about this suit, throughout which he maintained his complete innocence. But the court hearings began in July 1985. We were going to show the Church of Scientology, I'll tell you that. We were going to get in there and kick some butt, if you will. Unfortunately, we ate most of our meals standing up. We lost motion after motion, creating the impression that Judge Mariana Feltzer, the judge in this case, was against us. So we looked into her. But an investigation into her earlier cases showed a very low reversal rate. That is, she was rarely found to be factually or legally wrong by the higher courts. She had a reversal rate around 4%, the lowest of any judge in that particular circuit. This was disquieting, to say the least. And then we get to clincher number 4. Judge Feltzer personally compared the AA5 materials and the Knotts materials, and she came back into court, and this is what she said in November of 1985. Now, this is a quote. Quote, "The court did not find the testimony of David Mayo credible on the issue of how he and the Advanced Ability Center came to have in their possession the documents in question in this lawsuit. The court does not believe that anyone, even Mr. Mayo, could have reproduced from memory materials substantially identical to those stolen in Denmark from the church. The documents are too voluminous, too detailed, and too nearly identical in substance and wording to have been created by Mr. Mayo without reference to the stolen documents. The judge ordered all of the materials, AA5 or Knotts, in the possession of the defendants to be turned over to the court." So that is the real story of the Knotts connection, as opposed to what you were told about it. It is by no means the entire why for the field crumbling. We'll get to that later. But it is a typical example of the kind of out ethics that has historically been present in splinters or squirrels or whatever else you want to call them. And it shocked me into beginning an independent search of what really had happened over the past 5 years in the field, as well as just the legal case. After I realized that I had been lied to by David about the Knotts materials, and then realizing that I had wasted all that time and all that money, I felt devastated, but I plowed on. I began to review the entire history of the field and my involvement with it. I wanted to know why it all turned out as it did. What I found could not be refuted. It's a story that's not been told. I think you all know that things just do not happen by themselves. People have to make them happen. And in the case of the field movement of 1983 and 84, it was made to happen. And I played a large part in that movement. You've all heard my tapes. Well, that's just one small part of the picture, the part of the picture we told you about and wanted you to believe contained in those tapes. I believed what I told you in earlier tapes. I didn't know that I was being sold a bill of goods and took what I was told as truth. I never could document all that black PR. What I was fed, and in what sequence, etc., was calculated to get me to pass on the PR and lies. For a moment, let's go back to the beginning. I resigned from the church in April of 1983. That is a story in itself, but I'll not dwell on it in this tape. Suffice it to say that upon a good, honest look, the seeds of my disaffection went back many years to a couple of situations from earlier times that I was involved in, which I never got myself handled on. Instead, I got more and more strident in my complaints as time went on. And as I've come to learn, many of the conditions I was harping upon to justify my departure in a time period when some had been attempting to stir up discontent had been caused by a management crew that had been kicked out for OutTech and OutAdmin in 1982. The ousted former leaders complained loud and long about management, the very conditions they themselves had brought about. And we shall encounter some of this earlier management crew very shortly in this tape. There are many things that could be said about this time period of early 83. For instance, about the real motivations of people who set up shop outside the church. A representative example is two of the key people in the LA independent field. They were known in the church for fluky tech and getting into offbeat practices well before they left the church. I'm talking, of course, about Val Stansfield and Tia Greenberg. And they proceeded to confirm my earlier opinion of them by inventing rundown, squirreling the tech, and getting into other practices. Let's pick up the tale from the summer of 1983, realizing that there was much that had preceded this time period, and this was not by any means the actual start of the incident. There were by now alarming rumors early on, like the IRS was going to take over the Church of Scientology, or it was all going to go bankrupt, and I put some of this information in earlier tapes. But I have to tell you that those were rumors, and those things have not come to pass. But the field thrived on those rumors, that the church would be going under any day, and it made joining the field more attractive if the CFS was going to disappear. The truth, as we now can see it, was something quite different. In fact, it was facts like IRS troubles that we'll omit from this tape. So that was the situation at the time, and here is how we capitalized on it. The Clear Center opened officially in the summer of 1983, and the AAC, which I helped set up, soon followed. I remember the beginning very well. The seeds were sown on a hot day in July of 1983. We all gathered in my apartment, David Mayo, John Nelson, Harvey and Donna Haber, myself, and my wife at the time, Vivian, a meeting that I'll call the birth meeting of the AAC. This was before I had done my tapes. This was before the AAC journals and the trips to Santa Barbara on weekends. These were meetings where plans were devised and scrapped and then reworked, and finally, it was the place where certain agreements were arrived at. I must confess that these initial meetings made a significant impression on me. I was electrified. I had never been on the Apollo, I have never worked at INT, and the stories that I was being told by this small handful, hour after hour, left me speechless. Well, I don't think I've ever been actually speechless, but let's say I was stunned. These were things that I'd never heard before, things that you'd never heard before either, and I assumed that if they electrified me, they would electrify you. And this I used to make my tapes appealing. Not to say that I was calculated, but looking back on it, that's how it happened. And looking further back into this area, I never really asked for the documentation on all the claims that were being made by David and the other members of the AAC, which I relayed to you quite faithfully in my tapes. At the time, it never occurred to me that David Mayo would lie to me. Besides, he had made the big jump like myself to leave the church. His jump might have even been bigger than mine. So you might say we were comrades where a certain amount of mutual trust was expected. Now, some 4 years later, I know differently. David Mayo, in early to mid-1983, was laying tile for a living. When we first met, he wanted to get ginned in on who was who in the L.A. field and how I thought he might go about getting something started. We discussed everything down to the general PR lines that would be used. But things don't just happen by themselves. People have to plan them out and make them happen. To think that the field movement started spontaneously is ludicrous. No, it was made to happen. I know, because I was there at the beginning, and I worked to help make it happen. I became a spokesman for the movement in its infant stages when it was really getting going. David Mayo and I discussed strategy at length and how to get his story out to the field. What you're about to hear may shock you. But that is not my intention, believe me. This may seem somewhat calculated, but I'm afraid in certain cases it was. The strategy which was worked into my tapes had the following guidelines. 1. The public that we were going to go after were Scientologists, primarily on lines at the church. This included any fence sitters or people who had festering ARC breaks with the church. We were mainly interested in those who already knew Scientology worked and were ripe for the plucking. We knew that unless we promised standard tech, we couldn't get many people to really leave the church. Mind you, I'm not saying standard tech was ever delivered. I'm only saying we had to promise it. We knew that we could only pull in the church public if we promised good standard tech. 3. This is where David Mayo came in. We pushed the line that Mayo was the highest trained terminal in the field and that he had data on the upper levels that no one in the church had, thereby giving the field its own attraction. A classic hidden data line. It tuned in perfectly with the inside or hidden stories about the ship and INT and so on. But the more data I got, in this research, the more I found Mayo's assertions to be false. But at the time I ate it up, hook, line, and sinker, and sold it like gospel truth, and it was very convincing. And what about David's knowledge of the secret, unreleased, upper OT levels? Well, I remember the time in 1984 when Mayo released his version of OT8, and what a flop. It was given to only a couple of PCs, and you never saw two more distressed PCs in your life. And that was the last we heard of David bringing out new upper levels. That's a little story you maybe never heard about.